tell me what's happening, what's the buzz? 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 Welcome to Friday, and welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. We're going to spend the next hour learning from and discussing the top stories of this week. If you are a public school student, you might enjoy watching these grown-ups argue because it means summer might last a little longer. But if you're the parent of a student, you're probably getting anxious that school might not start on time because the Seattle Teachers Union voted last night to go on strike on Wednesday. That's the day that school's supposed to start, but teachers could strike then if the union has no contract agreement with the school district by that day. Here to sort it out, KUOW's education reporter, Ann Dornfell. Hi, Ann.
How's it going?
It's good. I know that Seattle teachers in the district have fought before, so I don't know how serious this strike threat is. How far apart are they compared to past disputes?
Well, the list is pretty darn long. I counted 8 issues that they are in conflict over. One is, the perennial pay issue. They're pretty far apart on that. Also, teacher evaluations, how they're done, how discipline is handled, equity and discipline, the amount of recess that kids get. The union now wants to set a minimum on that for the first time. And you have caseloads for occupational therapists, speech therapists, other people who work with special needs students. That's just a handful.
Is that a basket of issues just sort of tossed in, or is there one thing that this is really about way more than others?
You know, when I speak to teachers, it's interesting because I hear all of those issues pretty much touched on. Recess actually has come up when I've talked to both elementary, middle school, and high school teachers. So I think that's interesting that's kind of touches a nerve with teachers of all grades.
And remind us what the recess dispute is about.
Right. Right now, actually, KUOW reported over the years that has reported for about 5 years now.
I first heard it from you.
Yeah. That Seattle schools have very different amounts of recess depending on which elementary school you attend, with schools in low-income neighborhoods tending to offer very little recess, sometimes just 15 minutes a day. One school even doesn't have scheduled recess. It's up to teachers whether or not kids go out.
And why is that?
Well, the main issue that they've cited is not so much how much time kids get in the classroom, but the kind of conflicts they get in on the playground. That recess leads to scuffles, which is not only a hassle on the playground, but also takes away time from classroom learning. And so they give kids less in order to prevent fights on the playground and after recess.
And why do they say some kids scuffle more than others?
Well, I think in some schools, do a better job than others of teaching kids conflict resolution skills. And let's face it, kids in tough neighborhoods often are a little bit scrappier than others. And if they're not, if they don't have some of those social emotional skills taught in the classroom, teachers have told me that it's really hard for them to work out a dispute over whether the ball was in or out or whose turn it was. And so teachers at other schools say they give kids a lot of recess because they think it's an important sort of lab for them to practice the conflict resolution skills that they're teaching kids in the classroom.
So teachers want more recess.
Right.
As for pay, how much does a Seattle teacher make?
Well, a starting teacher who does not have a master's degree in Seattle would make around $44,000 a year. And if you have a master's degree and some extra credits, you can make up to around $80,000 a year.
How are parents reacting to the possibility? And first of all, how remote? What are the odds that school doesn't start on Wednesday, do you think?
I wish I could give you an answer because I could plan my calendar a lot better. But having not been in the negotiation sessions, I don't know.
Yeah.
I will give some context. In the last dispute that I covered a couple of years ago, they were pretty far apart on a lot of things. It didn't seem as many items, but they got it together at the last minute. So a strike vote is supposed to be a message to the district that teachers are serious and they mean business. And to your question about how parents feel,
yeah,
I've spoken to parents who were actually on the picket lines saying that they agree with teachers and want them to be well paid and want recess for kids and all these other elements. But there are also many, many parents whose main concern is, what am I going to do with my kids? So they're not necessarily as, keyed into the political elements here as they are wanting school to start on time, by hook or by crook.
We're figuring out why Seattle school teachers voted last night to strike if there's not a contract agreement by Wednesday. And you heard a lot of reasons there, pay and recess and teacher evaluations. Any questions from our panel, by the way? Eli Sanders, Canute Berger, Erica C. Barnett with us all hour long. Hi, gang.
Hello. Hey, Bill.
What do you want to know from our education reporter before she heads out the door and goes into report?
Well, this isn't really a question, but I people make the argument that socialization is one of the most important parts of school. And it's hard for me to imagine how you do that without recess. I mean, that's in some ways kind of the point for a lot of people, is their kids getting to play with other kids and learn that stuff. And it sounds like it's almost like it's become a liability.
Or a punishment. It seems very unfair, the way that recess is being meted out, more for better behaving students and less for poor or quote unquote poorly behaving students.
Yeah, I have to say the thing that you said about kids in tough neighborhoods, just like immediately my bells went off thinking, you know, could this be in some way discriminatory? And I'm not an education reporter, you know, I don't know. But yeah, that sounds like punishment to me and not, proper socialization, which is kind of one of the main points of school.
Right. And, you know, some teachers I've talked to say, you know, for a lot of kids in low-income neighborhoods, there is an actual risk that they won't, you know, make it to their 18th birthday. And it's not because they didn't, you know, have enough seat time in the classroom necessarily. It's because they didn't understand how to avoid getting into, you know, violent altercations with people. And so that might be a more important lesson, according to some teachers.
As much as we've heard about standardized tests, is that not – that didn't come up in our discussion. How important is that in this dispute between teachers and district?
Yeah, I'm not hearing it a lot from teachers, but it was an issue that the union wanted the district to negotiate with them what the tests were going to be at the beginning of the school year, so they wouldn't have surprise standardized tests popped in the middle of the school year. They also, you know, draw parallels to how they are evaluated and how tests matter in that. And also with recess, they say that it's a testing issue because as the demand for high test scores increases, they feel like recess is getting stripped away also as a result of that.
Let's let our education reporter go report. Ann Dornfeld, one more thing, practical question. Are there child care options already being set up in case school doesn't come off on Wednesday?
Yeah, the school district said yesterday they were working with other city agencies to figure out some child care solutions. There are about 53,000 students in the district, so not all of them need childcare, but obviously there will be some for some kids, it sounds like, but other parents will have to scramble.
Following the story for you is our education reporter, Ann Dornfeld. Ann, thank you.
My pleasure.
KUOW's Week in Review. Should Uber drivers, Lyft, sidecar drivers be allowed to unionize? And if you don't drive around in the Uber X's, why should you care? Stay tuned. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. Eli Sanders from The Stranger, Canute Berger from Crosscut, Erica C. Barnett, the C is for crank. We're helping you figure out what happened this week and why. This week, a Seattle council member, by the way, we're on Twitter, you know, at KUOW, so we're live tweeting right now and watching your ideas. We'll get to our Facebook page, too. Our Facebook response is approximately the size of Mount Hood on the subject of what we should call Mount Rainier, and it's getting taller as we speak.
It's so erupting.
It is erupting. That's the word I was looking for. That's the verb. This week, a Seattle City Council member said he wants to help Uber drivers unionize. Uber, along with Lyft, Sidecar, these are companies that hire drivers, and you summon them on your phone app, and they show up and drive you around in their own cars. Cheaper than a taxi. They are independent contractors. Seattle Councilmember Mike O'Brien will introduce legislation that would allow them to unionize, a power he says they need in order to bargain for better pay.
When workers have the right to collectively bargain, they're much more adept at finding conditions that make sense for them, and I believe the whole industry benefits.
Why should you care whether Uber drivers can unionize? Let's learn more now from Elizabeth Ford, Assistant Professor of Law at Seattle University. Welcome, Professor.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, why are Uber and Lyft drivers not allowed to unionize?
Right. So the federal law that governs collective bargaining is called the National Labor Relations Act. And that act, generally sets the rules for how you choose a union, what happens once you do, what are the rules of bargaining. And in that law, the explicitly excluded are independent contractors.
Why are they excluded?
Well, that's a great question. Generally, an independent contractor is considered to be sort of its own business. We have now these organizations like Uber that are aggregating these workers and basically dispatching them. And we're still considering those workers to be independent contractors, but really it's kind of a new kind of employment.
Yes. Well, that suggests that if this is a new kind of dispute and we're just figuring this out, could Seattle's move to allow these drivers to unionize, could this be setting a precedent across our, what do they call it, our gig economy, our on-demand economy?
Right. Well, there's certainly going to be a question about whether or not the National Labor Relations Act preempts this kind of local regulation. And so the question being, well, should the regulation of collective bargaining be left to the federal government in all cases, even cases where the particular type of worker is excluded? And I suspect that that's an argument that's going to come up in the course of the debate around this, and perhaps if it's enacted after enactment in the form of litigation.
So from what I've read, Seattle would be the only city to do this. If Uber sues, who wins?
Well, we have, I don't know is the answer to that, but we do have some analogies in other, mostly state governments, filling in gaps left by the National Labor Relations Act. So, for example, the act excludes public employees. Well, states have come in and filled that gap, providing collective bargaining for that group of employees. The National Labor Relations Act excludes agricultural workers. And so some states, California being a good example, have stepped into that void and created collective bargaining schemes for those workers. I don't know of a local government, a city, that has stepped into that void and filled it. But I don't know that I see a distinction between a state doing it and a city doing it.
Yeah, I don't know the difference. So if states have done this, why wouldn't Seattle be able to do whatever it wants on this new front?
Well, we'll see.
Yeah.
Right. I can't imagine there won't be some debate or challenge to it, but it does appear that there's some precedent. This is a different situation. These sort of aggregating organizations are relatively new. I guess the technology around them is really what's new. Using an app to aggregate workers and then dispatch them is a new thing.
Can I back up and ask a dumb question? Why is the federal government so interested, or any government, in setting all these rules about who gets to be in a union and who doesn't? I mean, why is it the government's business how workers get together and try to join forces and try to get what they want?
Labor Relations Act was passed back in 1935 after the Depression, and the idea was if we don't provide some protections, if we don't provide some forceful enforcement mechanism, then we can't level the playing field and we are going to subject the economy to these boom and bust cycles. If we can create a more level playing field, the theory goes, we are more likely to have a strong and sustainable middle class.
Yeah, well, that's an argument being used now, is that so much of our economy more and more is getting taken up by these on-demand workers, these contract workers, that we're tilting the playing field if they can't organize. That's the argument anyway. Let me ask you, what do you think, Professor? Should Uber drivers be able to unionize or not?
Well, so I think that this new kind of employment that we're creating around using technology and these aggregating apps, we really have to think about how we create a space for those workers to negotiate in a meaningful way with the organizations that are if nothing else, dispatching them. So creating a space to do that and some regulation around it could really help us to sort of address this growing income inequality that we're all seeing and really is common good to try to do something about.
Professor Elizabeth Ford, Assistant Professor of Law at Seattle University, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So there's the argument, and we're going to get this legislation next week. Everything I've read is that Uber is going to sue, and we're going to find out. And we're going to find out whether this is a precedent for our contract economy or not. What do you think, panel? Should, based on what you've heard, should Uber drivers be able to unionize?
Well, I think yes is the short answer, but I think that that this is not really an entirely new type of business. It's not a new economy. It's a new form that it's taking. But look at Microsoft. You know, I don't know what percentage of it is now, but at one point it was something like half of their workers were contract workers. I've been a contractor many times myself, and you know, in that situation, as a freelance journalist, you know, or a contractor, you are. You know, farming your work out to organizations that exist to hire freelancers and sometimes freelancers exclusively, and they have a huge benefit over you in the same way that Uber does over drivers. So I think if we set a precedent for allowing contractors to unionize, it would allow, you know, it would give workers more power. And as workers, you know, as increasingly our economy depends on contract workers, they're going to become a larger and larger percentage of the workforce. So to exclude them from the power to unionize seems, you know, unfair and unsustainable to me.
You were asking earlier why people should care. It's the same reason that you want a happy teacher who has enough money to be, you know, productive in the classroom and comfortable in their life. You want to get in a car and know that the driver is not exhausted from working too many hours and that they are alert and ready to provide you a good service because they're being provided fair compensation. So if the drivers feel that they want to unionize, I'm not sure why I wouldn't support that.
I guess I'm a contract worker or, you know, a freelancer, free range, whatever. And, you know, it used to be that that kind of thing was a lifestyle choice. You chose freedom. You know, you could have your own hours. You could work wherever you want. And not a lot of people did it. I mean, some people did it, consultants and whatnot, but it wasn't a thing. You know, Microsoft and companies like that, as Erica was saying, really turned it into an alternative employment force where you were doing it kind of en masse. And, you know, so whether it's unionization or some other kind of organizing, it seems to me that you have to do that. And I thought what the professor said about the reason that we we regulate in this is to create a more stable and more fair economy. And I think that's the ultimate issue. Are people being exploited? Do they have the right to get redress together if they are being exploited? And how do you create an economy that restores economic upward mobility and as broadly as possible as opposed to the economy that we have now? So I'm all for it.
If you resent Walmart and refuse to shop there because they don't pay their workers enough, must you also refuse to take Uber rides and rides just like that? What's the difference?
Well, I don't think it's a refusal. I think that there are lots of options. And if, you know, if it is true that Uber drivers are making, you know, as one guy who's been making the rounds in the press said, something like $3 an hour, then that's exploitative. And there is absolutely no reason for me to participate in the exploitation of that worker.
And this is because they've still got to pay their car note and they've got to, you know, insurance and gas.
And there's all kinds
and
of fees that you have to pay to Uber. Uber has reduced the amount that they pay drivers per mile. And, I mean, it's such an imbalanced relationship. Uber has all the power in that relationship. And so, you know, I personally don't take Uber. I, you know, think there are problems with the taxi industry as well. And, you know, actually, I use Car2Go if I need a car. But I would not use Uber on principle just for those reasons alone.
A Seattle council member wants to help Uber drivers unionize, and we'll learn more about that next week. Coming up, if you're lucky enough to have a solid job and you can afford to live in Seattle, you can get a move-in discount, so it's even cheaper for you and maybe more expensive for others. We'll get into that in just a few minutes. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. You're listening to KUOW's Week in Review. Another big story this week, a course syllabus from Washington State University made national headlines. The class is Women and Popular Culture, taught by Selena Lester Brikes. The syllabus spells out language that is not allowed in class, including illegal aliens and tranny. Students were also told to not use the words females or males. Why are these words so offensive, and do offensive words deserve to be banned from the classroom? Joining us now, Danny Aschini, Executive Director of the Gender Justice League in Seattle. Welcome, Danny.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, you don't know this Washington State University instructor.
I don't.
But why might a professor forbid calling women and men females and males?
Yeah, so I think it's partly about being academic or, you know, being academically correct. So male and female are medical or biological descriptors of somebody's body. But we would say in women and cultural studies that men and women are social roles that people fill. And so for transgender people in particular, you know, using biological descriptor terms might not actually be accurate to talking about all men or all women, which is, I think, where part of this originates from.
So it's not that men and women are better terms than females and males?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they're better, or I think they're different. And people use them interchangeably, but they're not actually interchangeable terms. Just right. Like we use sex and gender interchangeably, but we're actually talking about two very different things. One is a social role versus one is a biological reality, like your body. And so I think we tend to use them in our culture interchangeably, but they're not actually interchangeable words in an academic setting where you're trying to be accurate or respectful of all students that might be in that class.
I used to think of the term tranny as flippant, kind of like the word queer, until I got clued in that it's considered far more offensive than that. Why is that?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is the history of how it's used. And it can be used in a flippant way or a reclaiming way. And it is also a generational question. You know, generations change in the terms that they use. We know this throughout history about what is considered respectful or disrespectful. And that's one example of a word that for many folks who are of my generation or a younger generation, we've only ever heard it used in a negative context. And so it's not liberatory. It feels oppressive. And so I think that as language sort of shifts, the reality is that we've also in the trans community created a lot more respectful language. And our expectation is that other people who care about us and don't want to harm us will take the effort to learn some of that language, which is, in an academic setting, a really important goal of academia is to learn, be in a learning setting and be willing to be open to hearing that the language you might have historically used isn't necessarily the most accurate or respectful language.
In general, you have said that you support this Washington State University professor's disallowing these words in class. Why?
Yeah, so I mean, I think there's a lot of things that we have to take into consideration, you know, like the graduation rate for instance, there's no real data on LGBT students, but certainly African-American students' graduation rates from colleges and universities hovers around 42%, right? 42% of African-American students who start at a college or university ever get a degree. And part of that is about the culture that is created in classrooms where people feel excluded or don't feel represented in the curriculum or don't feel safe in the discourse that's happening in classes. And we know that 74% of LGBT students in high schools are verbally harassed in classrooms. And certainly we don't have a lot of the same concrete numbers in colleges and universities, but a lot of that harassment continues. And so I think for teachers to set a tone or an expectation, and I wouldn't necessarily do it in a syllabus, I might do it in an opening conversation about what the environment should look like, is really important. And we do have a lot of other expectations of students around their professional conduct, how they will, you know, write up lab books in chemistry class. There are some expectations within academia, and I think that this is one type of set of expectations to make sure that all students can participate in class.
As you know, there's been criticism lately that colleges are over-policing language. Some schools warn students of trigger words they might be exposed to, and the concern is that we want our students to become capable of handling a world in which people have free speech and they might hear ideas they don't like. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I think that I kind of would pull apart sort of those examples from examples that are specifically malicious, discriminatory, or harassing of students. And we know that educational institutions, tend to have work best for a certain class of people in this culture, which is people who are white and male. And that's reflected in who are tenured professors, who are in the top academic roles in schools, who are presidents of universities, and who is the most likely to graduate from schools. And so I think that it is an important and noble project for universities to be setting about figuring out how to create environments that make sure that all students who walk in those doors, who have demonstrated success to get to that university, are able to leave and graduate that university. And so I don't think that it is being overly PC to try and create an environment where people can succeed.
Eli, you and I talked a little last night about this question of whether colleges are over-policing language.
Yeah, first of all, I appreciate the discussion, and I'm learning just from listening to Danny Iskini talk about this. I actually did not understand the distinction that people are making between male and man and female and woman, and I consider myself, I work at The Stranger, I just got gay married, like I'm not ignorant of a lot of these gendered issues, but I'm learning in this process, and I think of colleges as an environment where people should be able to learn and should be able to make mistakes. It should be able to say male instead of man and, be corrected and learn from it. And one thing that concerned me about this syllabus in Spokane was that it was like an automatic failure of the class if you said the wrong word, as I understood it. And that, to me, seemed too far. You were talking about people needing to have the right to be in a classroom without specifically malicious or harassing language. Mm-hmm. But really what that's about to me is intent. So if a person comes in and their background, it has not, caught them up on the distinction mm-hmm. between male and man, and they come into a class and say man when they should say male, and they, the floor opens up and they fall into the alligator pit and they, fail the class. That seems like a missed opportunity to actually educate that person and also expose people to the real world where not everyone is going to be reading from the same script of disallowed and allowed words and not know even why some are allowed and disallowed. And, I also want to highlight something you said that I think is very true. These things change and they change rapidly. I mean, we were talking about words to refer to transgender people, and even RuPaul was mm-hmm. in trouble about saying what some people now call the T word, which yep. Bill said earlier, and I don't know if he'll get in trouble for it. But like, RuPaul is not someone who's anti-trans, right? Mm-hmm. But she had to learn, and so anyway, I just think
he actually uses male pronouns.
Does he?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry,
a trap door will open beneath yeah. you, and you will drop out.
But this is what I mean.
I would like to hear Danny.
People should have the space to learn rather yeah. than just be immediately executed.
Yeah, and I mean, I think so. I actually have like a quote from the syllabus, and the syllabus was taken down off WSU's website. So it's actually hard to speak specifically to what the syllabus said, but I think that it's actually been blown a little bit out of proportion of what the syllabus actually said, which it said gross generalization, stereotypes, and derogatory or oppressive language are not acceptable. Use of racist, sexist, homophobic, transphobic, xenophobic, classist, or generally offensive language in class or submissions will not be tolerated. And it gives some examples, includes the man, which, is referring particularly to a specific type of people, colored people, illegal aliens, tranny, and so on, or referring to women and men versus males and females. And I think that what this professor goes on to say is that if I see it or hear it, I will correct it in class, which is what you're saying. Mm-hmm. And since it can be a learning moment for many students, but repeated use, I think, is the key, of oppressive and hateful language will be handled accordingly. And it doesn't really say like you're going to fail, including but not limited to removal from class without attendance or participation points, failure of the assignment, and in extreme cases, failure of the semester. And I think that, there are a lot of caveats in there of like setting a clear tone, which is like, repeated offenses, like if you're intentionally being offensive. And I get how some students might have read this and, been like, oh, I'm being silenced. I'm not being allowed to say what I want to say. I'm being thought policed. And I think that, there are some caveats in here that, to me, I wouldn't have done it necessarily in a syllabus, or if I introduced the syllabus, I would have had a conversation with students first. But I think like in other classes, there are especially this is a class on women and culture, right? In other classes where, for instance, you're taking a pharmacology class and you consistently are getting the names of various pharmaceutical classes wrong, you're going to fail that class. Or, you know, and so I think it becomes difficult because it becomes about people and their identities versus, you know, and there's not as much academic distance necessarily. But I agree, which is that I don't know that I don't believe in like discipline first as an approach, because I don't think that that's what learning is about. I don't think discipline works. And it's often disproportionately applied to what we know, people of color and so on.
I'd like to hear from Erica.
Yeah.
Well, you know, my reaction to what Eli was saying is that the problem is not generally people referring to men as males. And I think I know that that's an example that is potentially in the mix here. But the problem is that women are often referred to as females, which to me, a female is a farm animal, and a descriptor for a farm animal describing a woman as a female is inherently dehumanizing. And so I think that's the issue with that term. And the same thing with illegal aliens. I mean, when we're using terms that dehumanize a portion of the population and a portion of the classroom, you are actually saying you are not a full participant. And to the point about being exposed to the real world, I think people are overwhelmingly exposed to the real world. If you watch television, if you, you know, go online ever, you are exposed to the real world plenty. I think this is actually exposing people to the notion.
But that's passive. I mean, I have two daughters and a son, and I do want them to be able to step up and in face to face hear what they like and don't like, correct other people, you know, move on.
But that's what you're learning in a class. It says, hey, this might not have occurred to you, but when you say, hey, there's a group of females over there, that is dehumanizing and objectifying. When you say tranny, that is dehumanizing and objectifying, and it's not the right word, and language changes and be a little flexible. That is actually actively teaching people that they need to be a little more considered about their language and what it means.
Knut, anything to add?
It's really interesting. I mean, I guess that's one of the reasons people go to college, is to learn about this stuff. I mean, what you learn outside the classroom as well as in. I went to Evergreen, which, you know, was one of the inventors of PC. There was a lot of conflict there over various terms or approaches to things. I don't really have a problem with the professor setting the terms for how they want a topic like this addressed in class, because I think that's all. I mean, if you're talking about women in popular culture in particular, these are things that you need to know about and be sensitive to, and this is a way people can learn about that. If they were banning the student newspaper from using any terms whatsoever, you know, in sort of fiat, that I would have more of a problem with in terms of what people choose to do and say. I think we have to be, you know, really liberal about that, even if they say things that we find offensive.
We've been talking about this Washington State University professor who spelled out in her syllabus how she wants language used in her class. And since then, Washington State University has said the blanket restriction of the use of certain terms is not consistent with the values which this university has founded, and that no students will have points docked merely as a result of using terms that may be deemed offensive to some. So we're still talking about this, and as far as I know, the professor's still there, so we'll keep watching how the class is in. We're all watching and learning, and we've been talking about this with Danny Aschini from the Gender Justice League in Seattle. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
KUOW's Week in Review, back in a moment. If you work at Amazon, Microsoft, Boeing, several other big local companies, some landlords here will give you a special deal on renting an apartment. You won't have to pay as many move-in fees. Your deposit will be cheaper or even non-existent. In a city that's getting more expensive, is it fair to give financial incentives to people who already make money? Jonathan Grant says it's not fair. He ran the Tenants Union of Washington State.
Well, I think the real question here is, how can we make a more equitable city? And we have a situation where it seems like a neutral policy to give preferential treatment to certain employers. But when there is a disproportionate number of employers at Amazon, Microsoft, who are white, who are male, you know, it is skewing towards a specific population and having a de facto discriminatory effect on other folks, and I think also creating an economic barrier for folks to access housing. And I think that that's a real problem.
With another perspective on this is Richard Hager, who is a landlord and a real estate appraiser. Richard, why should people who work at certain companies get move-in discounts?
Well, it's kind of up to the property owner if they want to offer something like that. Now, in my case, I actually like leasing or renting units to the techs, to the geeks, if you will. I find that in a couple of them that I have over in the east side, the guy's there maybe long enough to sleep and take a shower, and then he's gone. So he's been there for 3 years, and I couldn't give you evidence that he's lived there for more than 8 minutes. So some of this I like. It's like you work for Microsoft. Oh, sweet. Come on in, because they live so lightly in the unit. They're in, they're out. There's not a lot of wear and tear. So could I offer him a little lower rent? Sure, because he's not going to be so abusive of the unit.
So just because landlords can do it, what about the argument that they shouldn't?
Well, I would tend to agree that to discriminate would be wrong across the board. But when you're sitting here saying we're going to give a discount to certain people, well, I'm also liking people who pay their rent on time, who I know will be paying the rent, who have good job security. So if I had to choose between somebody who is in and out of jobs every 60 days or somebody who has a very planted job, will be here and I know will pay their rent on time, it's kind of a key thing because I have to make my mortgage payments too, I would, of course, try to go with somebody who has a better economic stability, if you will.
John Grant, landlords have always considered salary and employment status. Really, what is special about this move-in specials for big company workers?
You know, it really kind of, you know, rubs me the wrong way, the idea that somehow tech people can somehow be more trustworthy. Like, what is it inherent about a tech worker that's more trustworthy, or that they're going to pay their rent on time or be a better neighbor than someone else in another industry where, you know, it might be someone who is more likely to be a person of color or to be, you know, a woman or a family?
Richard, what about the de facto bias in your assumption that tech workers make somehow better neighbors?
Well, mine wasn't a de facto. Mine was just a statement that I have found people who were working in this case, working for Microsoft, they were the first people in. They did not occupy the space very often. They were working their tush off, probably, you know, 12 plus hours a day pounding code.
Well, you know, I think it's also worth to note that in our language, in our culture, we have these coded terms for race. And they can kind of manifest in pretty specific or unique ways. And that's kind of what I worry about. Is this becoming a coded word for race? And, you know, that's why the city of Seattle passed source of income discrimination laws, because class and race often kind of run parallel to each other. And that if you're saying, you know, we're not going to rent to this economic class of people, what you're actually saying is you're not going to rent to a specific race or other protected class.
Well, I somewhat understand if it does become a coded, you know, for instance, I'm only going to use people who used to live in Magnolia or something like that, you know, where it could be used somewhat discriminatory. Absolutely. I understand that. But at this point, we're not there. And so are we going to have government micromanage everything? Great socialism, but it doesn't really work. If the government wants to take over telling me what my deposits are going to be, I got a better idea. Come in and buy my unit. I'll sell it to them. Market value, the government can run it if that's what they want to do.
That's Richard Hager, landlord. And we also heard from Jonathan Grant, formerly of the Tenants Union of Washington State. Let's check in with our panel. Knut, we know that you get the rich get richer. If you have a good job history, then somebody will be attracted to that. If you want to take out a mortgage, then you'll get a better interest rate if you can show a good credit history and income. If you buy insurance, you might get a break on your rates because you live in a zip code that your insurance company likes. So my original question, how fair is it in this case, for landlords to give financial incentives to people with jobs?
Well, I think, to me, part of what's outrageous about it, and it is outrageous. I mean, I read the Stranger story, and I felt like, you know, I was totally naive. I had no idea. It's the specificity of it. You know, if you work at Microsoft or if you work at Amazon, it doesn't. If somebody works in a bike shop and makes the same amount of money, that they're discriminated against. And I think it has these other effects that Jonathan Grant was talking about. And if you look at the reality of what's happening in this city, where a lot of regular people can't afford rent, and people whose very presence are helping to drive the rents up are getting, you know, discounts, it just offends my sense of fairness. And I know it's complicated. I know there are a lot of issues, but I really think it's outrageous behavior. I think there are a lot of people who need good housing who would qualify in general, and they just don't happen to work for one of these select corporate giants.
Erica?
Well, I think that it does seem discriminatory. I also think that it is actually incredibly common. I am always sort of recently on the lookout for a new place, and the preferred employer discounts are everywhere. I was doing a little research last night and looking at my hometown of Houston, and I want to say, I mean, dozens and dozens of companies came up that offer these discounts. Now, I do agree with John Grant that it results in discrimination, either inadvertent or completely intentional, and I don't think that I think that we should be doing something to address it. On the other hand, there is an issue of whether it is discrimination by the landlord if the employer is paying for this. So if it is in fact just sort of a benefit the employer gives, like giving the employee cash to put down a deposit. And in many cases, it is the employer paying it. I talked to the Office of Civil Rights yesterday, and they told me they didn't know if there would be a difference in, you know, in making a case. They're looking at, you know, the issue of whether this is discriminatory and whether it benefits a certain class of workers. And it may make some difference as to, you know, whether it's the landlords deciding that they just prefer tech workers because they don't mess up the units as much, or whether it's Amazon saying, you know, here's $1,000 toward your, you know, your move-in costs. I mean, Amazon does pay for movers, for workers to move across the country and all kinds of other things to make it to ease their transition into Seattle. So is this just another perk?
I agree with Knut that it's galling, and it's specifically galling because of what's going on in the city right now, people being priced out of Seattle, and everyone feeling that in general, the employees of these companies, Amazon, Microsoft, the employees of these so-called preferred employers, have everything stacked toward them in the city, and people who used to be able to afford to rent apartments here and live here have things increasingly stacked against them. And so you go on.
But anybody who has, if you have a job, life is stacked in your favor. If you have money, life is stacked in your favor. What's the special difference here?
Well, I'm talking about the feeling that something is galling. And so it doesn't have to be completely rational. It just has to actually feel galling. And I think this does. And I don't think it would be a bad idea for the council to look into this. And I'm actually really interested to see how this ends up playing in the council races. You have John Grant coming out and very articulately saying why this is more than just smart business. It could have discriminatory effects. And I imagine he'll come forward with some proposed legislation. What will Council President Tim Burgess, his opponent in the November election, say about this? And how will that play? We've seen how housing issues are such a potent force in the council elections. Look at the Sewant race, for example. So that's something that I'm very interested in. What's the remedy here?
I would just say that, I mean, one potential and unintended consequence of this is that it would also bar the city from doing things like, you know, or would bar landlords from doing things like preferential treatment for artists and for other types of people that the city has decided it does want to keep in the city. And, I'm not a lawyer. I don't know if that would happen. But what occurs to me is we do try to give benefits in this city to people who contribute to the culture that we want to have in the city. And I think that's a good thing.
So we may see this. Yes, Knut, last word?
I just wanted to add a point. Things would be a lot worse if there weren't a lot of good landlords in this city. And it's not that I want to defend landlords in general, but I know a lot of people who live in apartments, who live in mother-in-law units and whatnot, who live there because the landlords are not greedy. They're not trying to get in the highest bidder. And they're making judgments about the people who live in those apartments in terms of friendship, in terms of believing that too much money is being asked for other apartments.
Well, that can be discriminatory, too, if a landlord just saying, I want to rent to people who seem nice. My kind of people.
Yes, it can be discriminatory, but it's also a fact that a lot of decisions are made that are people are trying to find ways to mitigate the market. And that's what we're really talking about, is the market as it's set up now is biased in favor of the well-to-do and not anybody else.
So we'll watch. This might be contested, and I think the country could be talking about this, if this were a serious challenge to this practice as being a de facto kind of discrimination.
In any council contest where you see candidates on opposite sides of this, you will hear people talking about it.
We've been talking about in a city that's getting more expensive, is it fair to give financial incentives to people at some of our big local thriving companies? This is KUOW's Week in Review. And last topic, if Mount McKinley now goes by its native Alaskan name, why are we calling it Mount Rainier? Stay tuned. Knute Berger, Erica C. Barnett, Eli Sanders, and I are evaluating the news of the week. And this week, President Obama announced that North America's tallest peak, Mount McKinley, will once again go by the Alaskan native name Denali. Since we're renaming mountains, why should Mount Rainier be named after a British admiral? Not, I don't know if he's admiral. He was a British admiral. Knute, the Mossback, you're our local history expert.
Well, I mean, we have all kinds of features named after British naval officers because the British Navy came and during the naming conventions of the time were if you saw it and you got it on the map first, you got to name it. So
Vancouver
Island, Mount Baker, Vancouver, Mount Hood, Mount St. Helens, Mount Rainier. I mean, somebody once said that the Cascades have more major mountains named after former enemies of the United States than anywhere else. I mean,
yeah, Rainier fought against the U.S. Rainier, in the Revolution.
Yes, exactly, and did very well against us, too. So, and this has been an issue for more than 100 years. I mean, people have been debating since the 19th century what the name of Rainier ought to be. The citizens of Tacoma wanted to name it Tacoma, rename it Mount Tacoma or Mount Tahoma. The argument is that that was the more common, Tahoma was the more common Native American reference. It's a little more complicated than that. The mountain can be seen from a lot of areas, so tribes had different names for it.
And, right.
So there isn't a kind of a consensus. It's come up, I think the last big push was in the 1980s to change it to Tahoma.
We may have a swelling ground here on our Facebook page. It's overwhelming. People are saying call it Mount Tahoma. What are the odds that this actually happens and we're calling it Mount Tahoma, just like Denali is now the name of that peak?
Well, the difference is we don't have consensus yet locally. Which
only on the KOW Facebook page.
Only on the KOW Facebook
page. That's a start.
In Alaska, it was virtually, virtually unanimous and certainly bipartisan. And you had, and the state wanted, to call it Denali. And so if the local people make a decision, then the feds are going to be more inclined because Mount Rainier is on federal property. So they would have to weigh in. You could perhaps change it on the local maps, but to get it on the federal maps, you'd need to convince the feds. And they take into account things like usage and how long it's been called that and who named it and what the, so they take all that into consideration. Sometimes they make good decisions and sometimes they don't. Denali was blocked basically by Congress. The delegation from Ohio was right, keeping it McKinley.
On Facebook, Cy, first of all, points out that if Clinton wins the election, she might have the chance to name it Hillary Hill. But his other option is just selling it, Alaska Airlines Mountain, which is, could be lucrative. We've got the McCleary decision, and we've got a fund basic education. What do you think, Eli?
I'm for renaming. I do think, though, that we will get into a problem about what exactly the new name is. As Knut pointed out, there's not consensus even among the native communities in Washington State about what the name should be. But it makes no sense to have a mountain that's named after a person who fought against the United States in the Revolutionary War. It's
called forgiveness, Eli. It's the best reason to name it after a former enemy. It's called love.
Oh. Mount Love. I like that.
I wonder if there is much of a constituency for Mr. Rainier, Sir Rainier, whatever he was, in the United States as there was in Ohio for President McKinley.
Right.
You know, it's kind of hard to imagine what the outcry would be other than, you know, potentially the complaint that we're being too PC or, you know, or whatever. Republicans in Congress may conjure to object to this, but I think it should be a matter of consensus.
I'm telling you, there's consensus except for someone named Bravis on our Facebook page who wants to call it Mount Chocula. This is not a time for jokes, Bravis, okay?
How did we get the Salish Sea? Because that seems to have come about without, you know, consensus. That just happened, but it seems like a good renaming.
Who would know?
We don't have enough time for me to go through the lengthy history of the Salish Sea. But I'll tell you why it eventually passed. It was because the man, the professor who thought up the idea, it was naming a geographic feature that had no name. He was able to prove scientifically that the waters that make up the Salish Sea are a distinct geologic
entity. Oh, distinct from Puget Sound.
That's right. So Puget Sound still exists. All the stuff still exists.
And so does the Salish Sea.
The Salish Sea is an overlay that defines basically Fraser.
And we don't have enough time to tap the Mossback's knowledge.
Yeah.
But just come back again, won't you, Knut Berger from Crosscut?
For part six.
Erica C. Barnett from the C is for Crank.com. Eli Sanders, Pulitzer Prize winner at The Stranger. Congratulations on your marriage, sir.
Thank you.
Why'd you do it in Montana and not Washington?
My husband is from Montana.
Oh.
And what was Montana's that? Beautiful.
Yes, I've heard. Andy Hirst produced the show this week. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next week.